Okay, Bob and Cameron are back with session number 18, and we're going to pick up exactly where we ended off, the cul-de-sac that Cameron would get himself into if he actually was invited by the White House to come in and implement somehow his program, or explain to them his program and see if they'd bite. Is that enough introduction?
Sure, sure.
Okay, so I go to Siddle in Cameron's blog, McLuhan's New Sciences, a topic called Citadel of Inclusive Awareness. Let's see. Cameron starts off with a quote in a letter from McLuhan to Jacqueline Tewitt. "We live in a global village, and the job is to create a global city." That's 1960, December 23rd, I think. It starts off, "Bob Dobbs has emphasized the importance in McLuhan's work of, quote, the citadel of individual consciousness, footnote 2. Indeed, McLuhan himself marked this importance by repeating in the 1969 counterblast this same phrase from 13 years earlier in the 1956 article, Educational Effects of Mass Media Communication. This is what is said. I'll give a few lines before we get into the meat of this quote from 1956. "We must substitute an interest in the media for the previous interest in subjects. This is the logical answer to the fact that the media have substituted themselves for the older world. Even if we should wish to recover that older world, we can do so only by an intensive study of the ways in which the media have swallowed it. But no matter how many walls have fallen, the citadel of individual consciousness has not fallen, nor is it likely to fall, for it is not accessible to the mass media." So that's a really important quote that I just read from 1956, and then he repeats it in 13 years later. So Cameron says, indeed, this is an important theme that Dobbs mentions in his essay. And then Cameron says, what may be the deepest questions, what may be the deepest questions probed by McLuhan are, who, when, and where is this citadel? What does it do? How does it go wrong? How might its function as a kind of gyroscope be put right? And then I'll just add the little bit that, so that's your questions, important questions. And then you say, citadel derives from Latin civis, which means city. And McLuhan explicitly drew on this etymology in the passages below, culminating in the idea of the citadel slash city as the central nervous system, also in brackets, a.k.a., as we might say today, the operating system. In a letter to Jackie Tewitt, in 1960, he set out a notion of the city as the social census communis against which his citadel text should be read, his citadel text. And so we go back to the key point. We live in a global village, and the job is to create a global city. So Cameron has been asked to go to the White House to create a global city. And you started. So you want to talk about the mystery of this
right,
citadel.
So we ran out of time last week for me to sort of complicate what would be going on. So one of the great problems that we face in the world today is that the United States and NATO Russia and China on their side, that countries are spending trillions, multiple trillions of dollars to endanger the world. The question of peace in the world is hardly posed anymore. Back in the 50s, 60s, and 70s, people were very conscious of nuclear weapons, and then the war in Vietnam. And this consciousness of the desperate need for peace has been more or less lost. And so one question that might be seen as posed by McLuhan throughout his life is, how do we find a piece of media, P-E-A-C-E, how do we get a piece of media that can be translated into a piece for the world? And McLuhan constantly called his work a strategy for survival. And I believe that he thought that unless we could establish peace for the media, that it was highly questionable whether human civilization, maybe human life or the biosphere, could survive. So these are very deep questions. But the great problem is that if you go to the White House, or if you go to a foundation, or if you go to a newspaper, or if you go to universities, the question of establishing a peace can't even be posed. And why can't it be posed? It can't be posed because the extreme danger of the world is a result of a cul-de-sac into which Western civilization has entered, and which blocks perception of the people and institutions affected by it. What that means is that if you go to the White House and set out a program, there will be absolutely no understanding of it. This is leaving aside the impossibility of ever getting into the White House in the first place. Mm. But even if you were able to do it, and it doesn't matter if it's a Republican or a Democrat sitting there, they're not going to be able to understand the question of peace, because they have solidified their identity and their perception on the basis of nihilism, on the basis of having lost themselves in a cul-de-sac, having lost themselves in the end of the print era without knowing how to get into the new electronic era. So the very difficult question that we face today is that the only answer to our problems for most people, and for all people in power, the question cannot even be posed. They do not have the perception or the possible approach that allows them to understand either the danger or the possible solution to it. And so the greatest danger that we face is that the very people who are formulating and financing the danger have no conception of anything but danger.
Right. There is an office in the government there in Washington, Office of Technology Assessment or something, and Hazel Henderson was on that. I knew her. She was a friend of William Irwin Thompson, and she was an economist, but she contributed to it, and they claim to be studying the effects of technology. Maybe if you brought in one of them and they heard you talk to whoever your audience was at the White House, they'd help it be understood. Or would you say, no, what McLuhan's saying is not something that the Office of Technology Assessment would come up to?
Yeah, correct. I would say the latter.
Yeah.
And the reason for this is that McLuhan's idea of communication, which he often said was so rare as to be almost an impossibility. McLuhan's idea of communication requires a kind of somersault from one sense of order into another sense of order. So the sense of order that nearly all people of power exist in is one that has no bridge to another sense of order. It's gapped from another sense of order. In order to get there, you need to go through a somersault or you need to take flight. You need to leave off one sense of identity and go to another. And what's happened in modern civilization is that we've lost all of our initiation rites that used to take identity from one sphere into another sphere. We've lost Hegel called the absolute spheres of human life. And those were three: art, religion, and philosophy. And in the modern world, we don't have any of those. They're gone, right? The philosophers are all careerists, and religion has dissipated, and art has become a kind of laughingstock, something that you pay people to throw out on the screen. It has nothing to do with traditional art.
So the right. whole, but wait a minute.
Go ahead.
So McLuhan said the media environments were the new art forms. So managing them or looking at them as art.
Correct.
That's right. What he pointed to.
Yeah, but you see, Bob, what I was talking before about this gap.
Yeah.
The whole purpose of people in the cul-de-sac is to keep the gap at a distance, right? The whole idea of violence being a correlate with a sense of identity, which is or a sense of loss of identity, is something that McLuhan says over and over and over again. And why? Because the people that are lost in the cul-de-sac of nihilism are deathly afraid of the gap. The gap seems to them to be death.
Mm.
But if you want to manage media, plural, you need to immerse yourself in gaps. So in order to communicate, what you need to do is you need to lead somebody into what they most fear.
Mm.
And that's a very, very difficult problem. But it's a kind of that problem is a thread on which the future of the planet now hangs.
Right. Is that included in the statements, where we must explore ignorance for discovery?
That's absolutely. By ignorance, he doesn't mean you've forgotten about page 16 on some book. By ignorance, he means what is absolutely ignorant and cannot ever be illuminated, and that is the gap.
Yeah, in a way, Eric, at the end of Laws of Media, where he says that this new medium, new sea can't be charted and it's unchartable, is not the right way to say it. It can be charted if you know how to get in the gap and do something in the gap.
Right. But, I mean, there's a sense in which what Eric says there is right. The gap itself can't be charted. But you're also right that the media environment can be charted, definitely. In fact, it's McLuhan's whole point that not only can it be charted, but it's actually charted at all times by every human individual.
Yeah.
And how can that be? That it's because all human potential is always present to us at all times.
That's right.
We don't know that.
Right. In one of your Fiddle of Awareness blogs, there's three of them sort of related. You say we don't know how to receive. You italicize receive the transmission or something. You remember that?
Correct. Yeah, absolutely.
Yeah, that's what you mean.
Absolutely, because reception, in McLuhan's sense, is the same as communication.
Yeah.
So there is communication coming to us, what he calls light through. Right?
Yes.
So the light of possible communication is always coming through to us. But the condition of being in the labyrinth, the condition of being in nihilism, is a rejection of that. Because in order to receive light through, you have to go from the order of light on, which is our illumination of whatever we're looking at, to one of reception of illumination.
Yeah.
And these two orders are gapped. And in order to get to the order of reception, you need to take flight, or you need to take the somersault into a new order.
So you have probably said a bit of that before.
Yeah.
How do we get to what you said to me about the mystery of what is the citadel? Is that the question?
Yeah. Well, I mean, I think that is a very important question that McLuhan's work from start to finish raises, and I don't think he ever came to a satisfactory answer, which isn't saying that, his work was useless. I mean, just think about it. Somebody identifies elements starting in 1780, and then it takes 150 years or 170 years for DNA to be identified, right? So there's nothing about science that says that the most important questions have to be identified in the beginning.
Right.
No, there are important questions that are identified in the beginning, but that opens a pathway which then leads on to other very important questions. So the whole question of the citadel is very important. McLuhan in Take Today is often talking about the nobody and the no man's land, which raises the question of the citadel. But in our case, what we're talking about right now with how do we get out of this cul-de-sac if we can't do it by just going to the White House, or if we can't do it by going to a newspaper or a foundation or a university, how is this going to happen? And this is a very, very difficult question. Let me try to pose the problem this way. Suppose that you're on an island and you have a society there. Everything's been going fine. You have fishermen, you have shepherds, you have everything that you need for your life. But then the weather changes, or the way that the fish stocks suddenly aren't coming the way they did, or the sheep and animals get a disease and they all die. So you're on this island, and it looks like the society is going to die. So the natural thing to do is to bring together the most intelligent people on the island and say, what are we going to do? Right? And maybe these most important people were, maybe there was a weaver, or maybe there was a shepherd, or maybe there was a fisherman, or maybe there was a woman who did whatever she was doing. So the island would naturally say, we need these people to figure out what the hell we can do.
Mm-hmm.
Do we have to leave the island, or can we get new skills, or what can we do to survive? Right? Well, if we look at the planet and we think of it as this island, The idiots that are that may not survive their idiocy are not bringing the most important people together. Right? In fact, what we do through our foundations, through our universities, through our elections, and so on, is that we elect or fund people not to think of the most important things. It's quite incredible. Right?
Right.
We take people that are absolute geniuses, and we say, okay, so think about particle physics for a while, or compose musical stuff on a piano, right? Or be the Minister of Foreign Affairs or some damn thing.
The MacArthur Fellowships.
That's right. It's exactly what an island would not do, right? Imagine an island in extreme peril.
Yeah.
And they say, well, you keep on being a shepherd, and you keep on weaving things. You keep on cooking your great banana bread. I mean, it's absolutely nuts, but that's our situation.
Okay, now wait, let me say something. So that's Congress. That's the politicians. But the Rockefellers and other billionaires, elitists, they recognize that, so they try to bring together the greatest minds in the Bilderberger conferences, the Trilateral Commission, the Davos thing that they do in January every year or so. That's an attempt to make the smartest people, but I know you would say they got the wrong standards for who the smartest people are there, right?
Well, I don't know. I mean, maybe those are the people with the highest IQs. Right. Maybe those people are very smart. But the problem is they are all lost in the cul-de-sac of nihilism. And therefore, they cannot formulate the proper answer. Right. It's one thing to come together in a Bilderberg conference or in Davos or something like this. It's completely different to say, OK, recognize that we're in extreme danger and we need to bring together some sort of a group that is going to be selected, not just from, let's say, NATO countries or something like this. We need to bring together a group who are going to formulate the possibility of peace, right? So because on this planet, the island only has two options. Either it's going to survive or not survive. And the goal of the island has to be, what's the path to survival? Well, on the planet, either peace is a possibility, or truth is what I was talking about last week. Either peace and truth is a possibility, or they're not. And if they're not, the world will probably die from that deficiency.
That's right.
However,
so listen to this. So McLuhan said, if you had a problem in some field, put it on television. And this is back in the 60s, you know, with not many networks. And take a couple hours and have the experts who are puzzled lay out the problem. And McLuhan said, probably you'll find someone in the audience who just has the peculiar weird consciousness to figure it out, even though he wasn't necessarily trained. Is that what you're thinking we could do?
No. The problem is that that would be a very wonderful thing to do. For example, there are shows, I've never seen one, but I know there are shows on television that try to identify the best talent or the greatest voice or whatever.
Right.
But so if it was actually possible to broadcast the problem that we have, the likelihood of us exterminating ourselves, and ask people for an answer, that would be wonderful. But of course, because the means of communication and the people who decide what's going to be on those means and the people that own those means, because they're lost in the cul-de-sac of nihilism, that's not possible. These are not people that recognize the problem. These are people that actually live in the problem. They draw their sustenance and their air from the problem. They cannot perceive of the problem being solved.
So you're talking about they wouldn't give up the 2 hours for media?
Yeah. Well, of course they wouldn't.
Okay, but maybe if it got really serious the corporation now are pretending they're woke and they're doing ridiculous strategies,
yeah.
You know, and they're more interested in appearing proper in the public perspective than making money, someone said the other day. But the let's say there was a sense of crisis and the media president said, yeah, we got to do this. Let's say they could do it. You don't think that would solve it. Do you think we would get some breakthroughs?
Well, first off, if something like that were actually broadcast, that itself would be a breakthrough. That itself would amount to an acknowledgement of the problem.
Yeah.
Right now, there's no acknowledgement of the problem.
Right.
All we're doing is spending money to make every problem worse.
That's right. So this would be a performance of the question.
Correct.
Like the most accurate way to perform the question is an environment.
Well, one of the ways to, who knows the most accurate, but just to pose the question of how we are going to survive on this planet.
In that broadcast.
Yeah.
Yeah.
That would be tremendous, regardless of the answers, just to get people, to have the powers that control communication to be able to conceive that is really a problem and a great question. That would be something.
Yeah, but that would be Finnegan's Wake. Here comes everybody, and Finnegan's Wake's already laid out the results, 60 languages on each page, you know, 628 pages. But let me see, there was another. So it looks like Finnegan's Wake, the answer might. You know how they did Live Aid and these concerts to raise money for starving nations and things?
Yeah.
That, they thought that they were expressing some emotion of multitude, to quote Yeats, that McLuhan liked, that quote. And that everybody would, on a Saturday afternoon, you know, all engage and watch this. I remember this happening in July, I think, 1985.
Oh, sure.
With that Bob guy.
And then it was taken up by Coke ads and stuff.
Right. So that's not it. What you do is you don't come and bring stars on and play music to soothe their sentiments. You actually create a global consciousness or parliament where everybody's a member. You know, that's real universal consciousness made possible or made manifest. And then everybody would be making all kinds of suggestions. But maybe the fact that it could be done, that's like what you're saying, is that's the breakthrough to actually show this situation in that format.
Right. And I personally don't think that is even remotely possible.
Well, many groups get on Zoom and they get maybe, you know, 1,000 people listening. It's hard to get everybody, but if you could pretend you're getting everybody and all the media cooperative just said, this is what we're going to do, we're going to do this on this date, and then everybody talks about it for 2 or 3 weeks to find out about it, everybody, a lot of people would look if they had the means, and a lot of people on the planet do. Matter of fact, most of them be on the phone, right? They'd be watching on their phone.
Right.
Not on TV.
Mm-hmm.
So
you see the question of dialogue, which McLuhan saw very early and is symbolized by his conversion to Catholicism. The question of dialogue is first and foremost a dialogue of times. The people that were alive in 1900, or the people that were alive in the Congo in year 750, were not less human, we're not less living in some kind of truth than we do today. Everybody lives in a bubble of significance, but the whole point of media ecology, the whole point of understanding media, is to understand the plurality of these orders of significance. So the great problem that we've come to in the modern world is everybody's got their nose in their phones. Everybody is thinking that they might be woke and all this sort of stuff, but they have no conception of the plurality of orders of significance, of the plurality of media.
And do you mean the plurality of subjectivities?
Yeah, that's correlate with them, sure.
Yeah.
Media subjectivities, perception, understanding, all of these things are always correlate.
So you're saying that people don't perceive how much is going on.
Well, remember that what is going on is everything.
Right? Yeah.
Amongst the things that are going on in the big now is the parents of the people with their nose in the phone that the people with the nose in the phone think are idiots. Right?
Wait, who thinks who's idiots? They both think each other are idiots.
That's right.
Yeah.
That's right. So what does that mean? It means that they have, and that's just modes of significance that are very close to us. Right? Think of all the millions of modes of significance that are out there that also need to be thought of, not in individual particularity, but they need to be all potentially valorized. Right? So one of the things that's going on in Finnegan's Wake with its allusions and suggestions and stuff is that everything can be extended. Joyce could not personally extend his book into the whole universe. Mm. What he could do is suggest that need for extension. So what I'm saying is that the problem with your suggestion about, okay, we're going to put something on TV and people are going to appreciate how the people in Mongolia and the people in
the people in Halifax.
Yes, that's right. All of these people have wonderful art and wonderful dances and stuff like that, and we're all going to be one, right? All going to be one. Well, if we really want to appreciate understanding media in McLuhan's sense, then what we need to understand is not the world anno 2021, not only that, but the world anno 1980 and 1945 and 1917 and on and on.
Mm.
And for this kind of consciousness requires a couple things. It requires humility, that is to say, who I think I am is not necessarily who I should be. It's not necessarily the citadel behind identity. So a kind of fluidity of identity is required. And then what is required is an ability to swim in the gap and so you have the personal humility, you have the ability to swim in the gap, and you have the ability to receive rather than only to broadcast.
Mm, right.
So these are kind of the preconditions of peace, P-E-A-C-E. And getting from where we are locked up in the cul-de-sac, locked up in the little now, locked up in the identity that is so fragile that it can lead to violence.
Mm.
These are tremendously difficult questions that McLuhan was sort of trying to use his sense of smell to get through over 40 or 45 years.
Mm. So you wouldn't you would do that, but what would be more important would be what you describe in the blog titled Medium in American Cosmic Man. And American Cosmic Man was a 1948 book by Wyndham Lewis that McLuhan thought was tremendous. And the word medium is used by its author, Wyndham Lewis, probably before McLuhan knew the word. And you have a
and
few
also
quotes.
Global Village.
Yeah, and the Global Village came out of that book, that concept. So you have in your blog quotes from the book illustrating the use of the word medium. Then you have this important part in your notes, and you say, it might be said that Lewis and Ezra Pound defined the cultural, social, political problem that McLuhan felt called upon to solve. And it's something that you're putting on that you're feeling called upon to solve.
Right.
Now, cultural-social-political, might McLuhan add a dash media to that, do you think?
Well, media is more his proposed answer than the problem. But you say,
Hold it now. You've got you need to adjust your phone or mic. You're getting distorted.
Oh, sorry. Okay.
Yes, yeah, speak a little more.
The phone back to its former distance.
Okay, I think that's all right. Anyways, cultural-social-political-media, you're questioning those four words for McLuhan?
Yeah, I wouldn't put media there because I don't think that there is a compared to the cultural, social, and political problems that we have. Media contribute to those problems, to each one of them, but it also is a potential answer in McLuhan's sense. McLuhan used the word media in many different ways, as you bring out in your book, as a matter of fact.
Yeah.
Media was as the active forces that structure perception. And in this sense, media are the elements of perception that I think are comparable to the chemical elements.
Yes. Okay.
So,
finish your sentence. All right. Lewis and Pound defined this problem that McLuhan felt called upon to solve and that Siegfried Gideon gave him in the 40s, the potential solution to it, quote, to defuse this gigantic human bomb by starting a dialogue. That's McLuhan's sentence. And you say, see Siegfried Gideon's book, A Faculty of Interrelations.
It was an article, not a book.
An article. And does Gideon say to defuse this gigantic human bomb by starting a dialogue? I know McLuhan says that, but...
No.
Yeah, that's his translation of Faculty of Interrelations, Marshall.
Yeah, so Faculty of Interrelations first appeared in, 1942 or 1943 or something. That was before the bombing of Hiroshima.
Right. So then you say, in the 1940s, with McLuhan's proposal to Robert Hutchinson, who was at the University of Chicago, and that was in 1946 or so, and still in the 1950s with the Culture and Communication Seminar that produced the Explorations magazine, in the 40s and the 50s, McLuhan took, quote, starting a dialogue, unquote, to be the practical problem of bringing together people with expertise and goodwill in a way that would fuse their individual and professional perspectives into an ongoing collective program. Now, do you mean bringing together, did McLuhan mean bring together people with expertise and goodwill, the best people, as we started off talking about?
Oh, absolutely, absolutely. So in his letter to Hutchins, I can't remember if it was in the cover letter or actually in the proposal itself, but McLuhan says that you need to have people like Voeglin in political science and Jill Sohn in theology, and it would cost a lot of money to hire these people away and to employ them, but that the situation was dire enough that this expenditure would make sense.
Yeah. Okay, so now these would be people, in your case, who are you going to pick?
Well, but remember, this has to be seen against the problems that we were just discussing, right? The great problems are that the universities, the foundations, the governments, and the corporations do not recognize the problem. And so they're going about their business just like the shepherd and the weaver and the cook and the fisherman on the island, as if in a situation that is disintegrating, it made sense to be going about their private business like this. Right? So that the situation that we have in the world is that the problem isn't recognized and cannot be recognized because it's a problem of perception.
Right.
It's a media problem.
Right. And the Black Lives Matter, Antifa, they thought it was such a dire situation that they took to waking people up by burning down little towns and things like that. That was a response.
Right.
Then there was those that thought that was ridiculous, and so they formed another faction. So the mob thing is not useful. So you almost have to get a secret think tank that governments or other influential people agree to respond to their suggestions. Or would it have to be public? Oh, no.
That's not going to happen. That's not going to happen.
Right.
Let's just back up for a minute to the mob scenes. Right. This is a little bit like graffiti.
Yes.
Graffiti, in part, is a way of saying to society, look, you give certain people the right to dominate attention, either through advertisements or for TV shows or political action or whatever, and those ways of dominating attention are corrupt. And graffiti, by illicitly grabbing attention, in one respect at least, is a way of pointing to the corruption of attention getting in other spheres. So with the when people burn down buildings and stuff, which of course I don't advocate, but it's a way of, an unconscious way of showing what the world is coming to.
Mm.
It's a way of saying the only way out of the cul-de-sac in which we find ourselves is violence. And of course that's what McLuhan talked about over and over and over again.
Right. So he would take these individual and professional perspectives and move it into an ongoing collective program. Now, you were saying last week the collective program would be clinics almost sent up around the
continent.
That
was your word.
Right.
I never used the word clinic. That was your word.
Yep.
But remember that the problem with last week is that we ended up talking about this only at the conclusion of our dialogue, and there wasn't time to complicate it. And so today I've tried to complicate it somewhat. And some
complicated,
of the complications,
a little more.
Okay, well, for example, McLuhan made this proposal to Hutchins in 1947, and people like Neff at the University of Chicago just said, well, that's ridiculous, forget it. then McLuhan himself tried with his Ford Foundation to have this kind of dialogue at the University of Toronto in the 50s, and he privately said that it was hopeless, that even the other four editors didn't understand the problem.
Mm.
So we're talking about very close friends, especially Carpenter and Easterbrook and
McLuhan.
Williams. You know, Williams and Easterbrook had been friends of his for, God, almost 30 years by this time.
Yeah.
So, and he just, it didn't work. It was an experiment that did not work, and it, so he had to think, how could this possibly be put right? And my suggestion is that what he learned at the between the time of the end of the seminar, 1955, up to 1960, is he came to the idea that the medium is the message, and that the only way out of this cul-de-sac was to define media in such a way as to enable collective research. And collective research is very different from a think tank. In a think tank, you have people with different points of view, and maybe they get together every once in a while and they talk about commonalities or something. But a collective research, like we see in science, starting, let's say, around 1800, is something completely different. It's something that can be used in commerce, something that can be used in politics, something that can be used everywhere, especially in education.
And what's that something?
Collective research.
Okay.
Right? So let's just say chemistry. Chemistry is basically born in the last decades of the 18th century and the first decades of the 19th century. And here we are a couple hundred years later, and the universities are completely different. Manufacturing is completely different. Making war is completely different. Our idea of the universe is completely different. All because, and the way we do medicine, the way we do everything is completely different because of what happened in those 40 years.
Yeah.
Right? Okay. So what McLuhan says is, what if we want to change things, we're not going to do it through opinions. We're not going to do it through a continuation of where we have been. We have to have a new sense of order. And the new sense of order has to be based on some common collective perception of the forces at work in human experience.
Well, we've had a few Silicon Valley people panic, and they say, run, get away from these computers, stop it. That's not what you mean. You don't think that's effective?
No, of course not. Of course not. It's like McLuhan said over and over again that the, especially starting in the middle 50s, he said, look, the values that we have from Gutenberg, so private individual rights, democracy, civilization as a whole, these things will not survive the electronic onslaught unless we achieve a new understanding. And what must a new understanding be? It's an understanding not of medium.
Okay, you got distorted. I think you said it's a new understanding of what medium means. Is that what you said?
Yeah, a new understanding not of medium singular, but of media plural.
Mm.
So McLuhan says a medium is only understandable in the spectrum of media. In order to understand the spectrum of media, we need to understand a medium is. Right? If we've got a spectrum of them, how do we know what they are? Right? And so McLuhan suggests end of the 1950s, which he was his first version of understanding media.
1960,
that's right. He says that if we are going to combat the corrosive effects of the electronic media, we need to understand what a medium is. How is it affecting us? How do media operate as environments? So what he's saying here is that there is a different kind of dialogue of which humans are capable. There's a dialogue of just talking, or there's a dialogue that has a kind of teleology to it, which is science. And for McLuhan, the answer to how the planet can conceivably survive is to study the humanities and all that the humanities are implicated in, like sociology and political theory and environmental chemistry, to understand these things. What we need to be able to do is study the humanities according to collective acceptances. And by collective acceptances, what I mean is we need to be able to understand what each other, what we are in common talking about, so that we can then critique each other's conversations in the same way as chemistry is based on a common understanding and makes its progress through common critique.
Well, there's not going to be much acceptance of the McLuhan terms as a common critique. I don't see how you can begin it without maybe just being a think tank in one place.
Right.
With visiting
and so,
scholars.
I think what happens or what could happen is that one or two or three or four people begin to do the research according to McLuhan's model.
What would that be? Can you state what that research would look like?
Yeah, absolutely. Well, for one thing, that's what my blog attempts to set out.
By defining terms.
Well, by defining terms, but first of all, by showing how thinking operates. Right? Earlier we were talking about the gap and the humility that's necessary and the ability to receive. And I attempt to show in the blog how that works.
And so what was that part? You show how the something, well, say those words.
Yeah, how receptivity, how humility, how acceptance works. How do these things operate together to be thinking?
Well, it seems that you've read so much McLuhan and you've familiarized yourself with it that you have come to a point where this is really significant. And then you might try to convince people it's significant. So I don't see how we get people to agree on the term set out in your blog.
Right.
I don't know why you think that's feasible.
Okay.
You could get a grant from some corporation. They value what you're doing, but you'd be by yourself and you'd start to reach out, but there are a million other think tanks doing that.
Correct. So
here's a thought. Could there be an unfolding through the media dynamics that is an ecology that's happening in front of us? You know, the media interactions. McLuhan always said they fed on each other and balanced each other off. Just humans didn't see it that way. But there could be. That would be part of the training of showing the piece that passes all technology, that McLuhan used to say that phrase, that we've arrived at. Because there's a lot of noise, but there's also a lot of silence. A lot of people don't contribute to the noise. They see it as noise and not productive. So that's the silent majority phrase came up in the 70s, 50 years ago.
Well, we need to tease apart some of the stuff you're talking about. So first off, when chemistry was first, when it first took off sort of as an independent science, it's not as if chemistry hadn't always been going on. Right? Everything had always been chemical. Everything. The birth of the universe, every bit of cooking that was ever done, every bit of breathing that human beings had ever done was chemical. It's just that what was recognized for the first time is what was going on in that chemistry. And it'll be the same thing with media. Of course, this contest of media that you're talking about is going on out there. It's just that we don't know how to conceptualize it and how to study it. So
And McLuhan showed how to study it?
I think so, but not just McLuhan. I think, don't get the wrong idea. I don't think McLuhan is the one guy that sort of came up with the answer to everything. I think McLuhan is a very interesting figure, especially for a Canadian like myself. But there's all kinds of tremendous minds. I mean, Plato and Aristotle and Hegel and Heidegger. I mean, these are minds that are just tremendous. But the thing is that they have not. Maybe they're so complicated, maybe the languages are so unfamiliar or something. They have not. Taken off, you could say, into a collective investigation. So my hope is that terms can be distilled out of McLuhan's work that will prove capable of forming the basis of collective investigation. And all that requires is me and one other person. And then those two can communicate with a third and a fourth. And finally, the end result of that is to have a means or a discipline of collective investigation that can conceivably form an answer to the horrendous problems of the planet.
Right. So what he came up with was, he knew he kind of cracked the code of experience. So he says, now let's review all the arts and scientists and all the cultural products by looking at certain, whatever the product is, its theory of communication. Remember? That's what he said. Let's review and look at the theory of communication of everybody in history that hasn't been done yet. Is that close to what you mean? We've come to the end. The last guy sort of came up with a pretty good 2020 hindsight in McLuhan's elements, and now we can go back and have a dialogue based on all the greats that cultures name and look at them through McLuhan's eyes.
Right. McLuhan in the 1970s was quite a sick guy.
Yeah.
He had serious heart problems. in 1970. Throughout the 50s and 60s, he'd had the problem with a tumor in his brain. So by the 1970s, he was pretty much running on fumes, and he was desperately trying to find a way to formulate a way of going on from his thought. And so the idea of theories of communication was one way, the laws of media was another way, trying to find different collaborators was another way.
Phidias classroom, would you classify that as another way? The method of...
Yeah,
the,
sort of, but to me that was... that's not his best work, and I don't think he really contributed much to that book myself.
All right, so you ended up with collaborators?
Yeah, collaborators and long interviews, like with Nina Sutton, but
yes.
Not only Nina Sutton, with Lewis Forsdale, for example.
Yeah.
Had some very important interviews. So all of these things are McLuhan being sick, attempting to sort of hand over what he was doing to the future. Right? And,
another project I've talked to you about, I won't go into it, but the guy here in Maui, Dave Greenberg,
yeah, yeah.
Doing a TV series like Kenneth Clark or something.
Right, right, yeah.
That
so
was the
I'm
last
an old
one.
Part, and my... I have I can readily appreciate McLuhan's problems in the 1970s because I have that kind of problem myself.
Right now?
Yeah.
Well, that's why I'm taking on your work, Cameron. I'm still vibrant because I got the solution.
There you go. There you go.
And you ought to take byproducts too, and you'll retrieve your energy.
Okay, good. Well...
No, what's interesting is I set out to do what you're talking about in the 80s on radio because I knew McLuhan. I knew enough about McLuhan that he had really come up with something, and more people need to know about it. So is that the beginning, if you were given the funds in this, to start to make more people aware of what McLuhan said, explained properly or some kind of brilliantly, and with a bunch of other people, maybe collaborators that attract attention, would that be the beginning point, what I did on the radio?
No, because the problem is, Bob, that the people who are speaking and experiencing at any given time are expressing the laws of media, but without understanding the laws of media. Then there is the huge multitude out there that are hearing the broadcast. And they, too, are expressing the laws of media as they hear it, as they hear the broadcast and talk about the broadcast and try to understand the broadcast. They, too, are living the laws of media, but without understanding them.
Right.
So there's no amount of talking at the level of merely expressing the laws of media that is ever going to result in anything but confusion.
Right.
So the only way forward as far as McLuhan was concerned, and I think he was right in this, is to understand human expression, which includes the way people understand things, the way people experience things, to understand human expression as an effect.
Yeah, but that's his idea. That requires listening to his explanation and understanding.
Yeah. Right. So but you see, listening and understanding are themselves effects.
Yes.
The problem is much more difficult than saying, well, let's just talk about this, or let's reach an understanding, or let's have a broadcast to everybody in the world. Now, that's not going to work because all of that is effect. We're not getting at the causes or the grounds.
But you're not saying what you would do to counter the conditioned responses.
Yes, I have tried to describe it, and that is that the start must be made in the medium is the message. The start must be made in defining the media in such a way that collective investigation of them can begin. And remember, it's very important in this context to remember that when elements first began to be isolated as elements between 1780 and 1820, in that period, it's not as if people began to isolate elements and knew everything about them. No, they started research into elements, which still is ongoing today.
Yeah.
When the basic principles of a discipline are isolated, that's not the end of the research of those principles, it's the start. So in talking about the media being defined in such a way to enable collective research, that doesn't mean that media have definitively been defined. It simply means that people have agreed on how to approach investigation in this field.
So you've defined a lot of defining and presenting of the laws of McLuhan and the cul-de-sac that he found himself in, then his approaches to alleviating it. You think your blog has laid that out better than anybody else? Like, take a look.
I don't say that, Bob. No, not at all. Not at all. I mean, there are things in Plato. There are things in Heraclitus. There are things in Aristotle, Hegel, on and on, that are just, it's like Bach or Mozart or Beethoven in music. Those things cannot be improved upon or bettered. No way. All we can do, it's like Eliot says in the Four Quartets, all we can do is take up the problem that's been handed on to us and attempt to bring it forward. That's all I'm trying to do in the blog.
Right, and I think a lot of people think they're doing that in their different fields. Now, Logan tried to define McLuhan. Did you read his book?
No.
All right, you knew not to. Okay, so you're throwing your effort on the pile, but just now it sounds like a new curriculum. You do the greats. Now, LaRouche recommended this too, Plato and people through history. But we'd have to include later media, not just books, right? That's music and films. So isn't university, any major learning institution, offering this mediocrely in mediocre ways? Because universities have film departments and literature, philosophy departments.
Right.
What are you? And I'm just gonna, I'm not necessarily saying this is what I think you're doing, but it's a question people would say. Are you just offering a new school?
Right. So I don't. There's nothing that you can say that I'll take offense at, Bob. You don't need to. Justify any kind of question. Any kind of question is welcome and fine. We need to come back to the start of our conversation today with the cul-de-sac of nihilism. Nihilism isn't something that is in a few people's brains. Nihilism is like a gas that has taken over the atmosphere of the world. And so most people have never heard of the word nihilism, have no idea who said it or anything like that, but it's what they breathe. It's what they see. It's what makes their life. And it, the whole question of the cul-de-sac is, given this noxious gas, which has taken over the life of the planet, how do we get out? That's a very difficult problem, and one that McLuhan tried to address, but he wasn't the only one.
Well, we're unique. I'm unique in having a pretty good grasp of McLuhan and the cul-de-sac, but we actually have ingredients that big farmers recommend is realizing we have that's better than them. So McLuhan didn't have things for body health. I might have had a chiropractor he recommended or something, but they didn't have products that are sold around the world. Plus, we have a endless electricity device, and we're actually talking. You know, in a way, I've been invited into the White House, and we are talking to the White House. Mainly, it's the Department of Homeland Security and what we're offering. So there's a whole agenda. So I started talking in the 80s, and 40 years later, got somewheres. Not that we're going to solve everything, but we really made great progress, which largely is secret, even though I get on the radio, 12-hour shows, and hint at it and talk about it. But I want to figure out what I'm not including by talking to you, right?
Yeah. So,
like, I might be in the position someday to be able to do all this stuff. I don't need the White House situation. I'll have millions of dollars, billions of dollars, and be able to do it. What I'm still trying to figure out, what would we do if you were advising me?
Remember some weeks ago I told you I needed to start making diagrams.
Yeah.
And you put me together with Clinton. And we've been working on some diagrams. And what I'm trying to do with Clinton is I'm trying to take sort of the quintessence of the dialogue of the blog and put it into diagrams. And I'm hoping that through the use of diagrams, it may be possible to initiate communication in a way that I haven't been able to do through words in all of the posts that I've done.
Would this be ideographic language?
Kind of. But,
yeah.
Really, I've talked before in our conversations about the spectrum of figure ground relations.
Yeah.
And, what McLuhan suggests for collective research is that whenever anything is being understood, it needs to be understood as the potential to be every position on the figure ground spectrum. This can be understood as something like Finnegan's Wake, where syllables, even individual letters, need to be understood against a background of possibility.
Mm.
But very few people are able to read Finnegan's Wake in the same way that very few people are able to read Heisenberg on the uncertainty principle, let's say.
Yeah.
And so the question is, can the whole idea of the range of possibilities be put into another form that is more communicable and can be used to actually investigate things? And that's what I'm attempting to do with my diagrams.
Oh, great. And you've already started with Clinton on that.
Yes. Uh-huh.
Okay, so... then I see you create a language, a product that people engage. Now, I took from McLuhan one angle is that the way the media was unfolding, the completing of our senses with the different media environments, there was a collective unfolding consciousness that was happening. Like he ends Take Today with Finnegan's awake, you know, a resurrection. There's that aspect of, and maybe he makes it into religious terms, like the second
right.
coming or something. But the we may have great, we have such collective consciousness now, even though it's for individuals, pinhead consciousness, I use that phrase. Everybody is concerned about the president. In that way, America is the Rome, you know, and it runs the world. And it's got a big problem over there called China, supposedly. But the way that we are a global campfire, or even less, remember his definition in the 50s, we're subatomic and super civilized. So we're super civilized on the TV level, but on the chip body or computer level, we're subatomic, interacting with millions. Everybody is, with whatever they're doing on their Black Mirror. So how much do you see something happening, evolving? So, okay, they say it's really dark before the breakthrough. So we get to some problem here. Biden's an incompetent, and he gets us into a lot of problems all over the place. But that leads into a flip, a somersault. Is a hope, a belief like that even relevant in McLuhan's
sure
studies?
Of course it is, because remember, the only way out of the cul-de-sac of nihilism is to swim in the gap that leads you into a different order.
Mm.
So in the past, religious belief led people to understand that the transitions, both in life and to death, are kind of natural and can be swum in. We've lost all of that. The whole condition of being in the cul-de-sac of nihilism is that the gap appears only as death. And so only to be something avoided. So the very thing that we need most, that is to say, dialogue of media, dialogue of perceptions, understanding media, can't even be attempted, because the prerequisite to that is to swim in the gap.
There's the cul-de-sac. There's the paradox. So
right.
You hope to be a representative of the solution by swimming in the gap.
Correct.
Having a gap about what you would tell the White House.
But I, as I said at the beginning, I don't think telling the White House amounts to...
Who would you like to tell? Is there anybody?
Well, you see, I think so. It's like the one in 10 million that McLuhan talks about.
Yes.
So in talking with you and in writing my blog, I'm not necessarily addressing any singular person. I'm addressing that person or those persons who can understand what I'm talking about or writing about.
Like Michael in the
Maybe.
Comments. He says, this is the greatest
Maybe.
Conversation on the Internet. So the so you're saying that it seems that you would you are going to, quote, limit yourself to a curriculum, an education, an institute. You welcome anybody else that has things going. What do you see is representative of the colossal nihilism we're experiencing? How could you prove that we're really in a bad... I'm in a compound here, all ages, and they live pretty good, peaceful lives.
Sure.
Occasionally they have a stroke or they die or something. But I'm not seeing the chaos in the cities. But that's... I'm on an island. I'm on your
sure.
island.
Yeah.
What do you see? So I don't see the chaos of the cities. I hear more and more about what's going on in the cities because I don't watch the news that much from other people, and it's pretty appalling. I'm glad I'm here. You don't have to go driving through the highways and that where you are. You can stay home a lot of your time, right?
Sure.
So you have a pretty peaceful situation.
Sure.
So what is an example of this nihilism?
Well, it's not everything is an example. that means that in order to see it, you need to understand its foundations. So Nietzsche said, what is nihilism? The question why goes unanswered. Right? Nobody knows. Everybody has lost their attachment to the earth. Nobody knows why they're here. Nobody knows where they're going. Nobody knows how to found their values, how to give a basis or give an accounting of their basis. And this is what nihilism is. Nihilism is a kind of petering out of reason.
Okay, let's say that every culture was relatively successful in the past. People knew who they were, but now we're in a new world where all those panaceas don't work. And we
Correct.
Always were adrift and lost and didn't know it. Now we can know it. Why make that a problem?
Well,
maybe we need to accept it. Well, you actually are saying accept the cul-de-sac. Recognize you're in it.
The cul-de-sac itself is an effect. Right? Everything is an effect. So the people that are in the cul-de-sac don't know that they're identity and values and everything in the cul-de-sac is an effect. So the number one problem for the island planet is that it's in the process of destroying itself. Right? We're spending trillions of dollars to make things worse every year. Right? And at this moment, we're killing people. Right? So Biden is saying Putin is a killer at the very same time that he's killing people, that Biden is killing people, right?
Yeah.
So it's we're in a situation that where things don't make sense, where the great shining city on the hill, the modern Rome, is spending all these trillions to wage war, and the man on the street, the woman on the street, has no idea why we're doing this.
But you're not a peacenik. You're not pleading peace.
Well, I am, but not in the traditional way.
Yeah.
What McLuhan was doing was trying to suggest another way of approaching these problems that would actually lead to peace rather than the peacenik solution, which doesn't lead to peace.
So you see McLuhan as the only solution today?
Nah, it's like, again, Bob.
See, I'm trying to put you in a box.
We can't.
I'm trying to put you in a box, and you're not going to let that happen. But
no.
It sounds like you are in a box because you have no other things other than the offer of the McLuhan questions.
That's not true. If you actually looked at my blog, and you could click, on influences, I've got posts on Aquinas, Aristotle, Bacon, Chesterton, Coleridge, Deutsch, Einstein, Eisenstein. I mean, I'm only up to the fifth letter of the alphabet here.
Yeah.
Right? I could keep on going. So
here, fix your mic.
Okay.
Just adjust it a bit.
All I did was move my chair a little bit.
Yeah, don't do that.
Yeah.
But so anyway, I don't want to interrupt your thought. So, yeah, you're just up to letter E.
That's right. So I'm very far from thinking that McLuhan is the be-all and the end-all and that you can understand McLuhan aside from understanding other people.
Yeah. But you're in the gap, and the gap includes that aspect that emphasizes McLuhan over the others. Because he lived at the end, so to speak. He had 20/20 hindsight. Nobody else did.
As you know, I don't believe in that chronological way of looking at things.
So, yeah, but in the gap, that can be included.
Bob McLuhan was not smarter than Plato. Plato saw better what's going on in human life than McLuhan did. But McLuhan is more accessible now.
Yeah.
So I choose instead of getting into contentious academic questions about Plato, I choose to take up the successful predictions of McLuhan, and then I try to say, how is this guy who died 40 years ago, how is he so prescient about what's going on right now? And that's a very interesting question, I think.
Yeah, and he's more prescient than anybody else of his era, of his life?
Absolutely. Yeah. Absolutely. Yeah. And he's more prescient about the particulars of our life today than Plato. Right? Plato doesn't have too much to say about the CIA and about atomic weapons and stuff like that.
Yeah, he got distracted by Atlantis. Okay, so I see what you're saying, sort of. Now, you there? It looked sound. Yeah. So let's go back to who, when, and where is this citadel? Would we start thinking and talking? Would you start quoting? Or you would say, this is something we don't know, and that's that. We'll maybe talk about
it. It's something that desperately needs investigation. Identity is correlate with spheres of perception, and just to take a throwaway example, let's just say that there's a sense of identity that's correlate with Gutenberg, and another sense of identity that's correlate with Marconi, and let's say that, as McLuhan himself says, people aren't only in one or the other. So if you have identities that are associated with both, then there must be something else that is somehow in flight above them.
Now, why is that? Why does there have to be that?
Well, because it's like Kant addressed this question, actually, but it's because if the same person, if the same Bob Dobbs can at one time perceive things chronologically according to the Gutenberg mode, and he's actually strongly inclined to do that, but at other times Bob Dobbs is excellent in a kind of jitterbug understanding according to the electric mode. If the same Bob Dobbs is in both of those, then there must be a Bob Dobbs that is somehow above those two identities.
Okay.
But that's a very ghost-like, strange nobody, as McLuhan says in Take Today. But if we are going to understand the working of media, eventually we're going to have to understand that nobody.
And you're the third position. What do I want to say about that? Is that covered by your phrase, the technique of flight?
Yes.
Okay.
Absolutely.
Yeah. The flight over the two.
Yes.
The flight out of the two to somewhere, to a third place.
Also that.
Yeah, and it's interesting how he did play with flight is in the quote to show.
Oh, whole life long, yeah.
All right, so... you know, he used to say, and we we talked about last week, movie was the car as airplane was the TV. So are we flying by the seat of our pants when we were watching TV?
Yes. Yeah. In fact, we're always flying. We just don't know that we are.
Yeah. Okay, so I think you need to say a little bit more about this third level. What has your research come up with?
Well, just I think that's actually what we've been talking about in our whole conversation today.
Yeah.
Namely, that if there is a level that can understand morality, media plural, that's understanding media, then that needs to be made concrete, needs to be something that we do in school and out of school, needs to be something that applies not only to individual perception, but also to society, culture, politics, war and peace. And that third position, as you're calling it, is a very, very important thing.
Yeah, and
By the way, there's Bob Logan in Toronto has done an awful lot of thought about this third position. I'm not sure if he's understood it properly in relation to McLuhan, but he's definitely understood the problem and has attempted to articulate it.
Where do you see that?
Oh, he actually put out a book about that.
But you didn't read it.
Well, the book that I'm thinking of is a book he edited, and it has pieces in it by McLuhan and others. And I've read some of those. I'm just, I haven't read Logan on McLuhan because I don't think he understood McLuhan in relation to the problems that he properly saw in other areas and which would be profitable to an understanding of McLuhan by him.
Right. Are you talking about, I have a book that's edited by Logan. You talking about the ones about faith?
No, I don't think so. I think it's called the third position or the...
Oh, okay.
I forget. I haven't seen it in quite a long time, but maybe next time I'll have looked it out if you would like me to do so.
Right. Let me just put in Robert Logan. You may have the wrong person.
No.
Okay, Logan, let's just try third position. No. Okay, I'll go over here. Third position for the violin, no. See, if you put in Robert Logan, you get TV shows.
I've got it already. It's called Canada's Third Option, and it was published by Logan in 1978.
Oh, that's real early. That's when he was working for the Liberal Party.
Early for Logan, but it's late for McLuhan. 78, he's on his last legs.
Yeah, that may be when he was involved with the Liberal Party.
Yeah, absolutely, it was.
Yeah, let me see. Candace, what was our third position?
Well, the third. Wait a sec, are you asking?
You. Or it.
Okay, but I mean, we've got a number of things up in the air here. I don't know if you're talking about Canada's third option, like Logan was talking about, or if you're talking about the third position that we were earlier talking about.
No, Logan, what is Canada's third position, can you say?
Well, I think what he was talking about is something that's actually quite quite close, excuse me, quite close to what Innes was talking about. Of course, in 78, Innes had been dead almost 30 years.
Mm.
So any sort of correlation is only rough. But the third option is to not be associated with or not to be identical with the position of the United States,
right,
and not also to take up the position of the Soviet Union, to be in a third position that was advocated by people like Lester Pearson.
Right. But it's not position, it's option is the title.
Yeah.
Candidate, so, option.
I mean, and actually the word option is important because increasingly in the 80s and 90s, that option would be refused. And so it was not something, it was option in the sort of disappearing sense. Canada chose to increasingly identify itself with United States in every way.
Yeah.
Culturally, politically, militarily, and there we are. I regard that as unfortunate.
Yeah, I have here, here is Logan. He did The Extended Mind, McLuhan Misunderstood, The Poetry of Physics and the Physics of Poetry, The Alphabet Effect, he did that with McLuhan, Understanding New Media, The Sixth Language, Collaborate to Compete, The Sixth Language, The Fifth Language. So he's got a lot of books out.
Mm-hmm.
And they didn't have the third option there. That's, I guess it's probably out of print.
Right.
Did you buy it many years later or at the time it came out?
No, many years later.
Yeah.
And I think the essay, I can't remember exactly which essay is in there, probably the one about
borderline
Canada. Yeah, exactly. That's so that's in many other books as well.
Right.
I probably just bought it to, you know, to have it as part of
the McLuhan collection.
Yeah.
Yeah. Okay. So back to the third option, the technique of flight, how you would communicate this. Have you had anybody respond seriously to your blog other than me or some other people? I don't know, maybe Andrew Crystal. How many people can you say really were serious consumers of your blog?
Very few.
That have told you. There may be people reading it that you don't know of.
Well, one of the problems I have in the blog is that I'm not able to take comments, although I would love to do so. But early on in the blog, it was attacked over and over and over again by spammers. And why they decided to pick on me and why they came up with innovative ways to do it, I don't know.
Wow.
But at the end of the day, we weren't able to shut it off except by turning off comments, which is very unfortunate. But for example, I said, well, let's just allow comments under review. And then I would get up in the morning and there would be 10,000
really?
Comments by the spammers. Yeah, yeah.
And this has been 2012, 2015?
Well, I started the blog in 2013, I think.
Mm.
So probably this was, we tried many different solutions in 2013 and 2014. And finally I said, well, forget it. I'll just write the blog for now, and we'll find a solution in the future sometime.
And you say we, who is the we?
Oh, the I work with a company in Germany to host the blog and to add features to it, like the advanced search.
So they're still doing it, hosting it for you?
Yes.
Oh, okay. And is that a company that you your career brought you in touch with, or you found it separately on your own?
No, my career brought me in touch with it, and then I invested in it. So I'm closely associated, put it that way.
Right, and friends of yours. Okay. You have made a discovery, and we're going to go into another topic. Though I don't know, maybe we can talk about a little bit more, but what the heck are you attempting to do? And McLuhan failed. Did McLuhan get somewheres because we picked up what we thought he was doing? And millions of other people think that they are doing what he's doing. I mean, he's taught all over the place, right? He's translated. He's spreading. But you don't think that's adequate.
Right. Because I believe that takes all of that takes place in the cul-de-sac, and it's like the people on the island going about their business as shepherds and weavers instead of concentrating on the fact that the island is in peril.
But why the heck would anybody listen to us say, you know, we're telling you McLuhan's more important, we're telling people, than whatever they're studying. That's Rabelais. That was the Manipian strategy. Everybody put down their plow and study me. That's what Rabelais said.
Yeah, so that didn't work very well. Right?
Nothing has worked. Maybe, well, look at what Duchamp said. There's no solution because there's no problem.
Mm-hmm.
Granted, looks like there's a lot of problems if you believe our lives are short and brutish and painful.
Well, Duchamp can be seen as a great artist on the island, saying there's no problem. Meanwhile,
everybody's got a problem.
That's right.
Well, it sounds like you would. If you had a little more support, even a classroom or a Zoom or something, that would be an improvement from where you are now.
Well, I don't know, Bob. I don't necessarily believe in improvement like that. That's a Gutenbergian notion. That's
okay.
Yeah. You tend to believe in things like that.
No, I don't. No, yeah, I don't. I'm more cynical than you. I've been doing this longer than you. See, you threw me off there. Let's see. Improvement. You're
trying to put me in a little bit of a box.
Yeah, and see how you wiggle out of it. You wiggle out of it.
That's right.
You've done pretty good. you're saying you're seeing this nihilism everywhere.
Correct.
And that's clouding your vision. You're seeing too much of it. But millions would agree with you. Billions might agree with you. But the agreement doesn't matter. Nobody can get a leverage point to do something of non-improvement.
Well, correct. That's why that's thinking needs to begin with that problem. Thinking needs to begin with the problem of nihilism, with the problem of the cul-de-sac, and sort of go from there. And if it doesn't go from there, then I don't see it as being
you don't approve,
anything other
and you
than
will not be
weaving.
Contributing.
Right. Well, it is contributing. It's contributing to our destruction.
No, that you would not contribute. If something didn't recognize
correct.
The cul-de-sac, you wouldn't assist them.
Correct.
Sounds like a Don Quixote operation, but You're doing pretty good at it. I think you are producing a very valuable archive of definitions or collection of quotes that nobody's collaging of quotes that nobody knows about at all. Matter of fact, you may be presenting McLuhan better than McLuhan did.
Well, we'll see. What I'm trying to do is present, or at least make McLuhan accessible digitally, in a way that I hope is representative both of his work and of his promise.
Right. Now, I had the thought there. That's what you're trying to do. Now, what was the thought? Funny how these thoughts come in, then they go away. We start off, we're trying to say, you wrote to me privately, says, Bob, before we go into your book, I want to define what McLuhan is, the end McLuhan in quotes. And that's what we're trying to do in this session.
Right.
Session
right.
Number 18. Have we defined what McLuhan is?
Oh, a little bit. What I would like to do, certainly not today, but I would like to perhaps take the post on taking flight and just go through it line by line. And I think that would serve to define what I take McLuhan to be up to, and therefore how I will participate in the dialogue with you about your book.
Okay, so we could have stated at the beginning and done that in 10 minutes, right? But we went all around the mountain. What was the name of the post? Which one? Technique of Flight?
Technique of Flight, yeah.
Okay, do I have that right here? No, I clicked that one off. So we don't want to do it now.
Right.
So you're moving towards ending. So let's hear, you told me a bit about this. You've made quite a discovery in the world of McLuhan, we could say, or in the world of communication.
We'll see. I would say the test of a discovery in communication is to communicate. And since I haven't cracked that nut, I would say that I'm a beginner.
Okay, but you did make this discovery, and introduce it. Tell me, do you begin with Rupert Lodge?
Oh, are you talking about the
new school
discovery of Maritime School of Communication, or what?
The Nova Scotia.
I'm not sure
school.
What you mean by this discovery.
You have created a new school, the Nova Scotia School of Communication.
Well, I don't know if I've created it, but I recognize that McLuhan was very much influenced by his associations with Nova Scotia, and many of his mentors also had roots in Nova Scotia.
So lay that out. Does it begin with Rupert Lodge or the guy who took over the Dalhousie Review or the guy at Acadia? Run through those three or four characters and how.
Right. So in Winnipeg, a teacher of McLuhan in English and a friend, a social friend of the McLuhan family, was a guy by the name of Watson Kirkconnell.
And how do you spell that?
Kirkconnell, Kirkconnell.
Okay.
So if you're looking him up on the internet, I think you'll find an incredible array of books of translation that he produced, usually in association with people that spoke the language in question.
spoke a language in question? What?
Spoke the language in question. So, for example, if you see a book by Kirk Connell about Icelandic epics, then usually he produced that work working with people that spoke Icelandic.
And it's written in English, though?
Yeah, exactly. It's a translation.
Okay, but it's Icelandic writing.
Yeah, or poetry, usually.
Okay. And he translated many different cultures, poetry.
Absolutely.
And he was in the English department. That's what people did back in those days. They were translators.
Well, but he's pretty unique in that respect.
Why?
Why? Because nobody was looking at Canada as this multicultural mosaic in those years.
Mm.
It was largely, there was the French and there was the English, and the two were completely separate, and that's the way it was. And Kirkconnell was saying, well, wait a minute, there's many other peoples and languages and poetries in Canada than those two, and he tried to make them accessible.
And he did. He made about 50 books, you told me?
Well, I don't know exactly how many books, but did a tremendous number in all sorts of different languages. And I think what was important here was that he was a little bit of a model like McLuhan's mother. McLuhan's mother staged one woman plays where she would play all the different roles.
Yeah.
And she also did readings of many different poets. And so in all of these things, she was assuming different identities, different voices. And Kirkconnell was doing translations from all sorts of different languages. So what the two of them were doing was they were giving McLuhan very early on an image of the human mosaic and of the ability to go from one component of the mosaic to another. And that sort of leap and that sort of appreciation was what characterized McLuhan from start to finish.
From McLuhan's
1920
appreciation?
Absolutely.
Yeah, okay, what years, what levels did he, was he McLuhan's teacher?
I don't know for sure that he was one of his academic teachers. I assume he was. But when I got in touch with the University of Manitoba to learn what courses McLuhan took, they wouldn't tell me.
Mm.
They said it was privileged information. Other people have told me that that's bullshit, that the guy didn't know what he was talking about. But nonetheless, I haven't been able to isolate what courses exactly McLuhan took. What we do know is he studied with Rupert Lodge. He studied with Henry Wright. And we know this from his letters where he mentions them. He mentions a guy down the street. I forget his name, but he took Milton from a professor that lived on the same block as McLuhan.
Mm-hmm.
And we know from his letters that he was personally acquainted with Kirkconnell.
Yeah, the letters show the evidence of their influence.
Correct. And not only their influence, but him being acquainted with them personally.
Right. Now, what's Kirkconnell got to do with Nova Scotia?
Right. So Kirkconnell went from the University of Manitoba to McMaster. He was a professor there of English. And from there, he became president of Acadia University in Wolfville. So I guess Kirkconnell must have been a Baptist because both McMaster and Acadia are Baptist institutions, like Brandon University in Manitoba. So the way the university system evolved in Canada was that it was very closely associated with religion, with the Catholic religion, especially in Quebec, but also in Toronto at St. Michael's, and then in all of the institutions across Canada that St. Michael's helped to found, like Assumption in Windsor, like Sir Thomas More in Saskatoon, and I forget the name of the college in UBC, but they founded one there as well.
Who are these, the Catholics or the Baptists?
Yeah, these were Catholic institutions, but the Baptists did the same thing. They had institutions all across Canada, and the Baptist institutions were interesting in that they largely refused to be consolidated. So even though McMaster was located on the same street as University of Toronto, in Toronto on Bloor, they would not join the University of Toronto like the other religious colleges did. And that led to McMaster moving away to Hamilton, and the old McMaster building became the Poli Sci building. That's where Harold Innes had his office.
Okay. Now, what years did he become president at Acadia?
I'd have to look that up. He would have been the president of Acadia for something like 15 years, and probably beginning in the early 60s until the late 70s would be my guess.
All right, so we have a friend, intimate friend of the McLuhans, ending up in Nova Scotia.
Correct.
And carrying his influence on McLuhan to Nova Scotia. Okay. Rupert Lodge had a connection to Nova Scotia. What was that?
Correct. So there was the Dalhousie Review was founded in 1921 by a philosophy professor by the name of Herbert Stewart. And Stewart was hired by Dalhousie, I believe, in 1913. Could have been 1912. And was about to leave England for Nova Scotia when his mother got very ill.
And what was he going to do in Nova Scotia if he got there?
He was going to be a professor of philosophy.
Okay, so but nothing connects him to the Dalhousie Review, you said, started in 1921?
Yeah, so he did start it.
Oh, so he did get to Nova Scotia.
Yeah, so the very guy that started the Dalhousie Review in 1921 is the guy who couldn't take up his position in 1912 or 1913, and the guy that substituted for him for one semester was none other than Rupert Lodge, the guy who would be the single biggest influence on McLuhan at the University of Manitoba.
But Rupert, that was one of his earliest academic positions at Dalhousie.
Correct. Yeah, it may even have been his first.
Right. So he had to get into the Nova Scotia vibe to later influence McLuhan.
Well, maybe that's one way of putting a potential there.
Yeah, and we may not have said McLuhan's mother was born in Nova Scotia. That's why we're talking
Correct.
About this. McLuhan.
And her mother was Marshall, after whom he was named.
Yeah, last name Marshall. And Marshall, born in 1911 in Edmonton.
Born in Edmonton. I'm sorry.
But that's just before World War One. When there was World War One, 1914, the McLuhan family moved to Nova Scotia, maybe in 1915, because McLuhan's father left the military, right?
When he went into the military, they moved to Nova Scotia.
While he was away.
But I think what actually happened is that McLuhan's mother's father, even though he was in his 50s, very characteristically for him, joined the military.
Mm.
Amazing. And so did his two sons. And so McLuhan's mother's mother was left alone in Winnipeg. And so...
No, in Halifax?
In Winnipeg.
Right,
in Winnipeg.
Right.
Yeah. So the Hall family had moved to Alberta, where the Halls and the McLuhans became acquainted, and through that, McLuhan's parents got married and had their son in Edmonton. But shortly after that, the Hall family, except for McLuhan's mother, moved to Winnipeg and started working in farms around Winnipeg. But then the father and the two sons joined the military and went overseas. So the mother was left alone in Winnipeg, and McLuhan's mother, who was also left alone because her husband had joined the military, McLuhan's mother decided to go to her mother in Winnipeg so that they all wouldn't be alone. And at that point, they decided to go to Nova Scotia because that's where their roots were.
Right.
That's where both the mother and McLuhan's mother still had all kinds of relatives.
And McLuhan was 3 or 4 when he went to Nova Scotia and lived there for a year or so as a young boy. Okay, that's the Nova Scotia roots of McLuhan himself. Now back to Rupert Lodge. He comes and teaches at Dal, and does he do anything at Dal?
Not really. It's just an amazing thing that of all the people who should have substituted for Herbert Stewart, it should have been the very guy that would prove so influential on McLuhan later.
In the 30s.
At Manitoba.
Yeah, at the University of Manitoba. Now, the third guy is Father Phelan, the mentor, or maybe there's a technical term, the guy who guided McLuhan to his Catholic conversion, right?
That's correct, but also did much, much more for that. He was the guy that got McLuhan his job at St. Louis University. He was the guy that got McLuhan his job at Assumption University. He was the guy that got McLuhan his job at St. Michael's. So McLuhan was very, very indebted to Father Phelan.
He's a major influence, maybe the most
huge.
Major, and yet...
Well, one of the most influential people in his life, for sure.
Right, and he grew up in Halifax, Nova Scotia, as a...
Correct.
...in a French family.
Right, and went to seminary there, became a professor at St. Mary's.
The Catholic University.
That's right, and a very large Catholic university. I think it was much bigger than Dalhousie back then, and I believe it still is. So he becomes a professor, maybe even during the war, but certainly after the war. He was a professor at St. Mary's, and there were probably only a handful of philosophers in Halifax at the time. And one of them was Herbert Leslie Stewart, who was going to establish the Dalhousie Review. and one was Father Phelan. So Father Phelan, when he was the philosophy professor at St. Mary's, was also the editor of a Catholic weekly. I think it was called The Cross, but I'm not sure of that.
Right.
But Phelan and Stewart were friends, and I believe it was Phelan who was able to give Stewart the technical information that he needed to start a review.
Mm.
So he needed to know, you know, where do you get the paper? How do you do the typesetting? Who does the printing? Who does the distribution? What are the costs? All of this sort of stuff. So Phelan was able to give him that kind of information. And at the same time, Stewart was giving information to Phelan because Stewart's specialty was philosophical psychology. And this would become Phelan's specialty as well.
Mm.
He would study it. He got a fellowship to study it in Europe at Louvain and other famous colleges in Europe, where he was able to study in French. And so when he was hired at St. Michael's by Henry Carr, I believe, he was brought to St. Michael's as one of the leading Catholic philosophers in Canada. Phelan was widely published in the top journals, not just Catholic journals, top philosophy journals, and was recognized as an expert in his field, but was also a expert in what might be called Catholic communication. He recognized great minds. He recognized the potential of McLuhan. He recognized the potential of Hugh Kenner, and both of them converted to Catholicism. Both of them saw that the exercise of mind was not somehow separated from an appreciation of religion.
Right.
And Phelan was able to sort of give that sense of things to people he mentored.
As a professor of psychological or philosophical psychology or psychological philosophy?
Yeah, both, I guess.
Right. Now, the reason we're... One of the subplots is that McLuhan first published, after his student days at the University of Manitoba, I think it is his first article, is in 1936 at the Dalhousie Review in Halifax. So McLuhan's career starts in Halifax.
Correct. And he joins as a person publishing in the Dalhousie Review. He joined Kirkconnell, Lodge, and Phelan, who we've just been talking about. So they and Stewart was their editor. So it's like we're putting together a bouquet of thinkers that are
surrounded McLuhan. They surround
that's
McLuhan.
Right.
Okay, so Phelan published at the Dalhousie Review. Rupert Lodge published there?
Yes. And he published there on the philosophy of education, which was a paper that McLuhan helped Lodge put together. And McLuhan may have played a role in getting it published at the Dalhousie Review. And that may have been one of the ways that he came to publish his article there.
Right. And you say in after the failure of the communication seminar in 55, that McLuhan sort of decided to move in by the end of the 50s into a role as a philosopher of education.
Oh, McLuhan had been known as a philosopher of education for a long time. So when McLuhan arrived at the University of Toronto in 1946, that was the last year that Eric Havelock was there. although Havelock was often at Harvard that year lecturing. But Havelock was, his family was still in Toronto, and Havelock was still working at the University of Toronto at the same time that he was working at Harvard. And Havelock was known at that time as a historian and philosopher of education. So I think that McLuhan, because he was known as a philosopher of education from his thesis, was brought together with Havelock in 1946 because of their mutual specialties. And it was through Havelock that McLuhan became interested in the Appelian form.
The Appelian.
Appelian.
Yeah.
Yeah. Very, very important for McLuhan's life.
Right. He used now, the Appelian method.
That's right. That's right. So then in as McLuhan was in the 1950s, as you just pointed out, he sort of took up the mantle that he had put aside in 1946, and as a philosopher of education or a theoretician of education, and began to both publish in education and to go to an astonishing number of conventions and meetings where he spoke on education. The real hero in the background here is his wife, Corinne, because imagine at this time she had six children that she was dealing with. Eric was still at home. He's maybe 15, 16. And then the other five kids. And so McLuhan is traveling all over the continent, speaking at education conferences, trying to make a name for himself. And poor Corinne is home alone, dealing with all of the problems of the kids, dealing with feeding them, clothing them, all this sort of stuff. It's she's a real background hero in all this.
Yeah. Okay, so we're talking about Phelan comes out of Halifax.
Kirkconnell.
Kirkconnell ends up in Nova Scotia.
Yeah.
Rupert Lodge is very involved with a magazine as well as teaching there, a literary review, the Dalhousie Review. And let's see, who else do we have? Kirkconnell, Phelan, and Lodge, and then the found Stewart, who created Dalhousie Review, he's in Nova Scotia, but is there something else? Does he have a connection to McLuhan other than publishing his article, his first essay?
No.
No other things.
Well, not only published his first essay, but then later, almost nobody knows that McLuhan published again in the Dalhousie Review while Stewart was still the editor. I forget exactly the year, but it was a review of a new edition of Maritain's Art and Scholasticism. We could look that up. But
right.
McLuhan obviously stayed in touch with the Dalhousie Review so that he published in it, at very different phases in his career.
Right, and McLuhan spoke several times in Nova Scotia. I know that. I know he did it.
Oh, absolutely.
Yeah.
And his mother put on her plays there.
That's right. There are newspaper articles, Halifax paper reviews of her. But here's the amazing thing that you discovered is that in that issue in 1936, where McLuhan was first published, was also an article by Harold Innes. Talk
Correct.
About that.
Yes. Well, it's often thought, partly because McLuhan told the story in a very distorted way, that most books on McLuhan say that he got to know Harold Innes in 1951, which is when Ennis was already very sick and he would die the next year. But that's nonsense. McLuhan got to know Harold Ennis personally at the latest in 1947, but maybe even in 1946 already. And he got to know Ennis's work already in 1936, because when McLuhan's first article was published in the Dalhousie Review, Ennis had a very important article in that same issue, and there's just no way that McLuhan would not have read that.
Right. Now Ennis, he's in Toronto in the late 30s, early 40s, and Northrop Frye meets Ennis before McLuhan. No, Northrop Frye meets Wyndham Lewis. I don't know if Ennis ever met Wyndham Lewis, but Northrop Frye met Lewis before McLuhan did in 43. But what happened is, if you read a recent biography of Ennis, he was greatly influenced by Wyndham Lewis, like McLuhan, in the 40s.
Yeah, I don't believe that. I mean,
listen, in the biography, the author.
Not everything in all biographies is accurate. It's true that Lewis probably read Time and Western Man.
No, Ennis read Time and Western Man.
Oh, I'm sorry. Who did I say?
Lewis.
Oh, sorry. Yeah, well, Lewis did too.
He
wrote them.
Yeah. But
so we know from quotations that Ennis read Time and Western Man and The Art of Being Ruled. And almost certainly he would have read those on the recommendation of McLuhan, probably through Easterbrook. Ennis had read McLuhan's 1944 article on Lewis, where he liberally quotes those two books.
Right, and we're talking about McLuhan's boyhood friend, who ends up being the top student of Ennis at the University of Toronto, I guess in the 30s or after the war, 40s?
Yeah, no, he would. Easterbrook was a very close friend of McLuhan. The two of them went to Europe together in 32.
Yeah.
After they both graduated, Easterbrook went to study in Toronto when McLuhan went to Cambridge.
Mm.
And Easterbrook was in political economy and studied under Ennis. And when he wrote his thesis in 1936, Ennis arranged for it to be published by the University of Toronto Press and wrote a foreword to it. So already in the middle 30s, Ennis and Easterbrook were quite close. Then when Easterbrook came back to the University of Toronto in 1947, he started working again quite closely with Ennis, and by 1950, he was one of Ennis's closest friends. And then from 50 to 52, when Ennis died, Easterbrook was almost a personal secretary, spent a lot of time with Ennis when Ennis was bedridden, helped Ennis finalize his last essays, and then later went on to a distinguished career in the same department where Ennis had been chair. Later, Easterbrook was chair.
Right. So, now, Easterbrook was not at the University of Toronto during World War II.
No. He was at the University of Brandon. And
oh, okay.
Why he wasn't in the service, I don't know.
Right. But, now, what's interesting, here's Easterbrook, a student of Ennis in the late 30s, approximately, even 1936. Ennis is in in the Dalhousie Review, we assume that McLuhan is letter writing, corresponding, maybe we could check in the archives, corresponding with Easterbrook in this late 30s, 40s period. He would hear about Innes, I'm sure.
Oh, absolutely. Absolutely.
You know, during the war.
Oh, there's no question about that.
And you're saying that Innes was introduced to McLuhan by Easterbrook in 47, maybe.
That's personally.
Yeah.
But I maintain that he knew of Innes's work at the latest by 1936, when that article by Innes appeared in the Dalhousie Review in the same issue as McLuhan's first essay. But, you know, McLuhan was very interested in Canadian history, and he may well have read Innes's fur trade book long before he came to the University of Toronto.
Yeah. Okay. And, I wanted a Wyndham Lewis scholar in England, Alan Mutton, discovered that George Orwell was very influenced by Lewis, leading to his 1984 book. Orwell, there's statements by him where he's puzzled and thinking a lot about Lewis. He's a little disturbed about what Lewis is noticing about media.
Yeah. Yeah, that makes great sense.
Yeah. So Lewis has had this kind of influence in a lot of scenes, and I'm saying, you don't go with me, but I'm saying he influenced two major communication scholars who are important for Innes in Canadian history, and Innes was internationally recognized. He was on the board of the Center for the Study of Democratic Institutions. I think that's what it was. And and then McLuhan went on to be famous. So Lewis is lurking in this. And Lewis was born, guess where he was born?
Amherst.
In Nova Scotia.
Yeah, a boat just off of Amherst, yeah.
Yeah, there's the Bay of Fundy that, you know, Nova Scotia is a peninsula. So the northern part of the peninsula that on the other side is New Brunswick, you go, it's down the bay towards Newfoundland, and you'll come to the isthmus, the little connection. Is that what they call it? The isthmus is the connection of the peninsula with New Brunswick. That's where Amherst is.
Correct.
Yeah.
That's where Lewis was born. That's right.
And someone did an article on early Canadian media theorists, and Lewis was included. And I think in 1939, Canada built a communications tower that maybe went to Europe. It was an important major communications tower right there in Amherst where Lewis was born.
It could be. In the 20s and 30s, people were putting cables underneath the Atlantic Ocean.
Yeah.
And those cables were going either from Nova Scotia or Prince Edward Island. Newfoundland at that time wasn't part of Canada.
But Marconi did, I think he did his first experiment out of Cape Breton, which is part of Nova Scotia, and then maybe he went to Newfoundland, I'm not sure, but he definitely did something in the Nova Scotia region. So the wireless comes in with Marconi out of Nova Scotia, and Lewis is there to reap the benefits a few decades later where he's born. Mm-hmm. So, wow, this is pretty, the global village, the global ESP comes out of Nova Scotia.
Well, maybe.
I mean, telegraphically, wirelessly.
A construction can be made along those lines.
What?
A construction can be made along those
lines. Yeah, the wireless is ESP, no connections. So, so we've done Kirkconnell, Phelan, Stewart, Lodge, Lewis, Innes, Dalhousie, the roots of McLuhan's family. Did we leave anybody out?
Not that I can think of, but we may find somebody later on.
Okay, so here's what happened. A major McLuhanite named...
Well, we may have left out Bob Dodds.
No, that's what I'm coming into. A major McLuhanite, a professor of English at St. Evex, St. Francis Xavier, a Catholic university in Antigonish, Nova Scotia. He started the Antigonish Review, popularized McLuhan a great deal through that magazine, was a great friend of McLuhan's, always visited Toronto at least once a year, and published a book on McLuhan. So right. Sanderson is the next generation of McLuhanites, so to speak.
That's right. And I forget the name of the father, the Jesuit father, that was a big influence on George.
What, McSweeney? McSween?
Yes, you're right. Absolutely. Good recall, Bob.
Yeah.
So I think it was him, actually, that started the Antigonish Review, and then George took it over from him. But McSweeney was also interested in McLuhan.
Right. And probably maybe drew George's attention to him.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah.
Wasn't it McSween? Not McSweeney.
No.
I think it's M-A-C McSween, S-W-E-E-N or something. No?
I don't know the answer to that.
Yeah, so anybody's interested, it's McSween or McSweeney. And then the world-renowned McLuhan scholar Bob Dobbs has spent many years in Halifax and started going to Toronto in the late 60s and meeting McLuhan from Nova Scotia, and then eventually became McLuhan's archivist. An ambivalent position, wasn't paid, but turned out to be important for the archives that I organized it so they could be sold to Ottawa. So another part of the Halifax School. Maybe, did anybody come after me? If anybody came after me, I brought them in.
Well, Terence Gordon.
Oh, Terence Gordon, yes, he missed my grasp, but guess what? I knew all about his writing of the biography, the second biography of McLuhan, because a close friend of mine who visited the whole McLuhan scene with me, Greg Skinner, who had a job at Dalhousie, he wasn't a professor, but he was a great friend of Terry, and I would get regular reports from Greg's conversations with Terry about how the biography was going. Or coming
there
along.
There you go. Yeah, yeah.
So let me just think of her. So Terence Gordon.
I don't want to put you off, but just to go back to the Antigonish Review, you were correct that it was McSween.
Yes. I used to read his poetry. I mean, I remember him.
Yeah, yeah. And it was I was right that he established the review, and then he was succeeded as the editor-in-chief by George.
Right. Let's see. I didn't meet too many McLuhanites in Halifax. If there were any of the population, I wasn't in academia, I introduced them to McLuhan. So I was the main propagandist for McLuhan and was known for that in Halifax in the 60s and 70s. But then I moved to Toronto in 77 and then started spending a lot more time with McLuhan. But I think I had one more sentence there.
But you had been traveling up to Toronto before that, right?
Yeah, since the late 60s.
Yeah.
As a matter of fact,
so you had already met lots of the McLuhan circle.
That's right. But
before 77.
I was able to drop in, and I started going to the Monday night seminars in 72, and I probably attended the most number of seminars. Because Eric was away often. De Kerckhoff was in and out. Logan didn't come in until 74, 75 or so. I met Logan in 75 with McLuhan. So Barry Nevitt certainly attended more than me, but he wasn't an audience. He was part of the performers. You know what I mean? He was part of the staff in a way. Let's see. I thought I had another little fact there. Moving to Toronto really, I was able to go around to all the libraries and archives and get all the articles. And then George Thompson found out about that, and then they named me McLuhan Archivist, but I didn't find that out until after Marshall died. But here is George Thompson, who succeeded Marshall's brother as the first aide to McLuhan, in the coach house, and he started about 72 or so. He ended his life visiting George Sanderson. They became great friends, and he would visit to Nova Scotia as much as he could. So George was feeling the attraction of the Halifax School of Communication, but
there
probably didn't know the impact of it, other than maybe he was interested in Nova Scotia and went up and looked at McLuhan's roots and all that, you know? Maybe that's part of the reason he went there.
Mm-hmm.
So I think we have established the Halifax School of Communication, and it started before the Winnipeg School of Communication.
That's right. It was, well, it, in some ways it was started before, in some ways it was established after. It was a very complex growth of roots.
In both places.
I was just, but intertwined.
Yeah, I mean, I've said that a big influence on McLuhan's PhD was his mother. He was trying to understand a rhetorician.
Mm-hmm.
So,
well, more than that, the trivium is a series of masks, and so McLuhan's mother on stage gave a presentation of what McLuhan tried to show in history.
Yes.
Right? The taking off and putting on of different masks.
Exactly.
That's what his thesis is all about.
It's about our time, right today. I haven't had to wear a mask yet, but a lot of people are wearing masks today.
Yeah. Well, that's a mask in the particularized sense, in the literal sense.
Yes.
In the proper sense, we all do nothing but wear masks.
Ah. Okay. So if I think of anybody else I left out as we inaugurate the new website, the Halifax School of Communication.
There you go.
We'll.
Well, a lot of this is already on my website. If you search for Nova Scotia, or you search for Dalhousie, or search for Acadia, or whatever, it's all there already.
Okay, so then we could. Can you put an audio on your site?
Yes.
Well, maybe I'll excerpt this part, and you put it in there and make a little blog title, Halifax School of Communication. I mean, you started, you pretty well named the Winnipeg School, right? No, you didn't use that name.
No, no.
You discovered it.
Well, I wouldn't put it that way. Jim in Toronto and...
they named it, but you did the research. They didn't know about Rupert Lodge and those guys, I don't think.
Oh, that's right. That's right. So, but, yeah, they... for them... it was the fact that McLuhan grew up there and went to school there, and there was an important hockey team there, et cetera.
Right, but no, you discovered the Winnipeg roots and the Winnipeg School of Communication, and you discovered the Halifax School. Now,
you did. But Jim Patterson and Rich Altman are important. Contributors to the Winnipeg School.
Yes. So you can write a blog if you want to. Did you ever write something with Winnipeg School of Communication?
Tons.
What?
I say tons.
You use that title.
Yeah. Yeah, I got that's one of the links on my website goes to the Winnipeg School of Communication.
And are you giving Jim credit for naming it, or did you name it at the same time?
Oh, I don't know. I think I have some links to some of Jim's artwork, and I have links to some of Rich's film. But if you click on the Winnipeg School of Communication, I'll bet there's at least 20 or 25 posts that touch on that.
Okay. What is Edmonton claiming? Not much, right?
Well, quite a bit, actually, because at least Edmonton has bought the house that McLuhan was born in, or if he was born in a hospital, to which he was taken back to after birth and lived in for 3 years. And so they bought that and turned it into an art center. And then later McLuhan got an honorary degree at the University of Alberta and gave the convocation lecture there. And then some of the people that he worked closely with established the White Pelican there, and that was
Watsons.
The Watsons taught there and published stuff on McLuhan and the White Pelican. And I'm trying to think, there was one other connection to the University of Alberta that just slipped my mind at the moment. But Edmonton is not totally unimportant for McLuhan, for sure. And that's where the nearly all of the McLuhan family lived in Edmonton in the, let's say, the 1920s. He had, I forget how many brothers and sisters, but maybe seven, and they all lived there except for his father.
Who had the seven brothers and sisters? His father?
McLuhan.
Marshall?
Had seven. Yeah, Marshall had was son of six or seven children.
Yeah, of McLuhan's father.
Siblings. Yeah.
No, wait a minute. McLuhan, as Morris McLuhan said, was an only child.
Yeah. So the McLuhan's father was one of a bunch of siblings, but McLuhan himself was, in Maurice's reckoning, an only child,
yeah.
And in most people's reckoning, one of two.
Right, but so you said Marshall McLuhan had siblings. No, Marshall's father had all these siblings, and they all end
Correct.
Up living in Edmonton.
Correct.
I see.
Yeah. Sorry, I meant to say that he had uncles and aunts.
Yeah. Okay, so whatever it was I think I was going to say, I forgot, and maybe I'll think of it, but I look forward to your blog on the Halifax School of Communication. No,
All
the
right.
Nova Scotia School, not Halifax.
Nova Scotia is probably better because of the Annapolis Valley and Antigonish.
Right, and we're the first to be a non-city title.
We are
a provincial title, a bigger zone of influence.
Yep.
But I like the fact that Wyndham Lewis was born there. That's pretty neat.
Absolutely. We need to bring in Amherst as well.
Yeah. Okay. I think that's it. Oh, I remembered.
Okay, good, Bob.
Wait, I remembered. Mm-hmm. Have you ever heard of Mr. McEwen at McGill University?
I don't think so, but I am aware that there's a lot of McEwens around in the academic world.
Okay. Have you ever heard of MK Ultra?
Yes, of course.
Have you heard of the McEwen at McGill who ran the thing?
Oh, yeah. Actually, I have. Yeah.
And I'm just thinking.
And it's some of the stuff they did was horrendous.
Yeah, his name is, what is this? Donald Ewan Cameron.
There you go.
Cameron McEwen, is your name in reverse? Let me see if I got it right. Yeah, there he is, Donald Ewan McCameron. Died in 1967, and he Some of his work took place in the context of the Project MKUltra program for the developing of mind control and torture techniques, psychoactive poisons, and behavior modification systems. So I had it backwards. So I was wondering if he was related to you, but no, the name is Donald Cameron. But there's something there, because I say that McLuhan exposed a larger mind control operation than the puny CIA one-on-one operation. So you're the mirror image of the puny operation. You adopted the weather level of mind control.
Yeah.
That's my part, folks. The weather.
This guy's name was Donald Ewan Cameron, right?
Yeah. Look him up.
He was actually born in the UK, I see. So, my father was Donald McEwen, right? And McEwen just means son of Ewan. So he's Donald Ewan Cameron. My father was Donald McEwen, and I'm Cameron McEwen, right? And my father's middle name was Cameron. He was Donald Cameron McEwen.
Wow.
So it's
it's intertwined there. We become our names, as McLuhan used to say. But what I think I had another thing I was going to start saying. So MK Ultra. Now I'm going to leave it there. Great session. So I think we may have established who or what McLuhan and the Citadel of Awareness is, sort of. Something, maybe not completed the Citadel of Awareness.
Yeah, it's a research project.
Right. And we need to, so consciousness is a research project.
Yeah.
The Citadel of Awareness. So we might start the book next week.
Yeah, okay. Well, I'd like to do the taking flight post.
Oh yeah, we gotta do that.
But we can get through that in half an hour at the outside, so we can do that and then go to the book.
Okay, all right. Thank you very much, Cameron. Another great session.
Okay, same here, Bob.
Okay,
take care.
Talk to you later. Yeah. Bye.